Chris swung his legs from the bed, his earlier desire to wallow in the thickness and warmth of the covers having evaporated once he remembered the purpose of Alan Pasteur's summons. At least now he understood the source of the man's less than friendly welcome. Quickly and without fuss, Arcturus cleaned himself in the sonic shower, a fine, elegantly designed machine. The brand wasn't one owned by the old families. Such independence was typical of most homes on Umoja, suspected Arcturus. It was, little to his surprise, efficient and thorough, vibrating the particles of sweat and dead skin from him without peeling off another few layers of skin for good measure. He shaved with a similarly efficient sonic razor and combed his hair, then dressed in a dark gray suit with knee-high boots. The suit had been cleaned and pressed, the boots polished to a mirror sheen. Alan Pasteur's servants were thorough, that was for sure. "Time to face the music," he said, and left the room, making his way along a marble-faced corridor that opened out into the entrance hall he'd arrived in last night. The door to the sitting room was open, and Arcturus could hear voices coming from within. He recognized one as belonging to Alan Pasteur and entered the room. Sure enough, the Umojan ambassador was sitting in the same chair his daughter had occupied the night before. He was talking to one of his functionaries, who took notes on a personal console with a wand stylus. Pasteur, his face an unreadable mask, looked up as Arcturus entered. "Good morning, Alan," said Arcturus. "Indeed," replied Pasteur. "You slept well?" "You have no idea," said Arcturus. "After nearly a year of sleeping on top of rocks or camp beds, I could have slept anywhere, but yes, I was most comfortable, thank you." "Hungry?" "Ravenous," said Arcturus. Pasteur nodded to his servant, and the man bowed before withdrawing from the room and shutting the door behind him. "Where's Juliana?" asked Arcturus. "Outside with Valerian, digging up the bottom of the garden, no doubt." "You don't have groundskeepers?" Alan smiled, though there was no warmth to it. "I do, but that's not what I meant. Valerian's quite the budding archaeologist. He loves digging in the earth almost as much as another young man I remember." "Maybe he takes after me," said Arcturus. "I rather think he does." "You sound disappointed." "No, just sad for you that you've missed so much of Valerian's life. The years when Juliana was growing up were some of the happiest I've ever had. But you'll never know that simple joy." "Hardly my fault, Alan," pointed out Arcturus. "I didn't even know he existed." "Would it have made any difference if you had?" "Honestly, I don't know. I am not blind to my own faults, such as they are, but I said I would stay for a time and get to know the boy, and I'll make sure he has the best of everything." "We can provide for him," said Pasteur. "I am a wealthy man, Arcturus." "I know that. But Valerian is my son, and I will provide for him. I'll not be beholden to any man, Alan, and I'll not be accepting charity. Even if this claim I found is worth only a fraction of what I think it's worth, I'll never need to worry about money again. Therefore, neither will Valerian." "Very well," said Alan. "That's good to hear." Arcturus heard the simmering resentment in Pasteur's voice and said, "You can't hold me responsible for not being here. Juliana never told me of Valerian." "I know that. But whether she never told you or not, the simple fact remains that you weren't. You didn't see her raise Valerian on her own. You didn't hear her cry in the night, and you missed everything a father is supposed to be part of. It's hard for me to look at you and not pity you for all you've missed." "Don't pity me, Alan," said Arcturus. I'll not have your pity. Very well, not pity, but regret. Juliana should have had you next to her through all this, but she didn't. And it wasn't because she never told you about Valerian. It was because you shut her out to pursue your own dreams. We'll never know, but I suspect if Juliana had told you before now, you would have turned your back on her and the baby. Am I wrong?
Probably not, admitted Arcturus. But I'm here now, aren't I?
Yes. And that's the only reason I'm maintaining a degree of civility to you. I know you, Arcturus Mengsk. You are a selfish man who I believe cares nothing for anyone else. I think you could be a very dangerous man. But you are the father of my grandson, and I'm willing to give you another chance not to disappoint me.
You're too kind.
I'm serious, snapped Pastor, and Arcturus was struck by the vehemence in the man's voice. You have responsibilities now, and if you fail to live up to them, I'll make sure you never see Valerian again.
That sounds like a threat.
It is.
Well, at least we understand each other.
Further discussion was halted as Pasteur's servant re-entered the room, bearing a silver platter laden with a steaming pot of sweet tea and a plate of pastries, cheese, and cold meat. The man held the platter next to Arcturus's chair, and slender metallic legs descended from the platter's base. Pasteur thanked the man as he left the room.
These are dangerous times, Arcturus, said Pasteur once the servant was gone. Battle lines are changing. Old wars are drawn to a close, and new ones are beckoning.
Are you talking about the Guild Wars?
The Guild Wars are over, said Pasteur. The Confederacy knows it, and the Kelmorians know it. They just haven't accepted it yet. The Confederacy is too powerful, and if the last shots haven't been fired yet, rest assured they will be soon. And then the Confederacy will be looking for its next target.
And what do you think that will be? Umoja?
Perhaps, said Pasteur. But there are steps being taken to protect Umoja.
What steps?
Steps I prefer not to talk about just yet, said Pasteur.
Arcturus wondered what Pasteur meant, but didn't press the point. If the man wanted to tell his secrets, he'd tell them in his own time.
"Have you spoken to your family recently?" asked Pasteur.
Wondering at the abrupt change of topic, Arcturus said, "Not for a while, no. But that's one of the reasons I came. I saw the broadcast on the UNN about the declaration of martial law.
Yes, things have become very dangerous on Cor Hall."
Arcturus poured some tea and helped himself to a cinnamon-topped pastry.
"So tell me what's been happening," he said. "I've watched the UNN reports of bombings, terrorist atrocities, and attacks on Confederate militia, but I imagine they're either wildly exaggerated or half-truths. And every communication I've had from Mother is so cryptic as to be unintelligible."
"She's being careful," said Pasteur, pouring himself a cup of tea.
"Confederate intelligence agents are monitoring everything that comes off Cor Hall, especially transmissions from someone in your family. The Sky Spy and the Summer Villa are almost certainly under all-round surveillance.
I know you and my father were behind most of the attacks against the Confederacy on Cor Hall. But are you really that dangerous to them?"
"More than you realize," said Pasteur. "Cor Hall is one of the most important worlds in the Confederacy, a model of what the earliest colonists hoped to build in this sector. For decades, the old families trumpeted Cor Hall as the jewel in their crown, an exemplar world that proudly displayed all they could achieve. They thought Cor Hall's example would be what would persuade Moriah and Umoja to join the Confederacy, but they were wrong. All it did was show us the yoke of tyranny ever more strongly, and now the Carhall's in rebellion. They're terrified that if their most treasured colony could turn against them, others might be tempted to do the same. Do you think my family's in danger? I know they are in danger, said Pasteur. They've been in danger ever since your father's close of session speech at the Palatine Forum. But then you'd have known that if you had stayed long enough to hear it. Please, let's not go down this road again, said Arcturus. It's old news, and frankly I'm bored with your throwing it in my face. Tell me about my family. Pasteur sat back in his chair, visibly composing himself mentally. You're right, I'm sorry, Arcturus, but I can still remember your mother's tears that day. It's not an easy thing to forgive. She's forgiven me. She's your mother, said Pasteur. That's what mothers do. Arcturus studied Pasteur's face as he spoke, seeing the deep lines around his eyes and the gleam on his pate where his hair was little more substantial than thin wisps of gray smoke. The years of clandestine support for his father's rebel faction on Carhall had not been without its price. Acton Fell's a good man, but he doesn't have the resources of the Confederacy. He's worked wonders in protecting your family, and he's been lucky as well as skilled. But your father's enemies only need to be lucky once, and it's all over. Arcturus was shocked. He had no idea things were so volatile on Carhall. The reports concerning his father had largely belittled his importance or depicted him as some kind of raving madman, which, he now realized, should have told him immediately how seriously the Confederacy viewed Angus. "Do you think the Confederacy will try and kill him?" "It's possible," said Pasteur. "Angus is such a valuable figurehead that they might attempt something that direct, but I think maybe his very visibility is what will protect him. If there's anyone with a grain of sense in the Tarsonis Council, they'll know that it may do more harm than good to target Angus." Arcturus snorted in derision. "Yes, and having sense is a quality the Council's known for, after all. Hence why I believe things to be so dangerous. Your father and Acton Feld have amassed a popular army that numbers in the millions, tough, disciplined, and loyal men. And the momentum and support your father's built up among the civilian populace in neighboring worlds means it's only a matter of time until the Confederacy's forced off Carhall for good. Sounds like they don't need any help, then." "Don't be so naive," said Pasteur. "This is just when the Tarsonis Council is at its most dangerous, when it thinks it might lose Carhall and have no other option but force." "Are you talking about an invasion?" said Arcturus, incredulous at the prospect of Confederate Marines storming the planet of his birth. Pasteur shrugged. "Perhaps. But I don't think so. Feld's army is well trained and has the very best weapons we could supply. Rifles, explosives, tanks, anti-air missiles, the works. Any invasion would cost the Confederacy dearly, and I don't think that's a risk they're willing to take." "And if you're wrong, then there will be bloodshed like nothing we've ever seen," said Pasteur. Chapter 14. Arcturus found them at the bottom of the garden by the side of a river. Valerian was industrially working within a small cove he had clearly dug by hand with a very small shovel, while Juliana sat nearby on the grass. Walking out to meet them, Arcturus took a deep breath of the faintly spicy Umojan air, enjoying the aroma of an atmosphere unpolluted by the venting of the Kitty Jay's engines or the reek of oil, scorched metal, or turned earth and rock. Aelin Pasteur's home on Umoja
was large and well-proportioned, fashioned from white steel and wide panes of bronzed glass, with a pleasing symmetry and elegant design that complemented the natural landscape, with the grass and trees constantly reflected in the glazing. Arcturus knew that such a dwelling would be both rare and expensive on a planet such as Umoja, where the climate was often harsh and land at a premium. The gardens before the house were kept green and lush by integrated water atomizers, and an army of robot groundskeepers tended to the numerous hedges and covered arbors that dotted the gently curved slope. The path Arcturus followed led down to a slow, meandering river at the far end of the garden, and tucked discreetly out of sight behind a sweep of hedges was the landing platform on which Arcturus's ship had set down the previous evening. They hadn't seen him yet. Valerian too intent on his labors in the dirt, and Juliana too involved in watching her... there, he corrected himself, son at work. Valerian stooped to retrieve something from the mud and proudly held it up for his mother's inspection. She nodded and took it from him, placing it on a tray beside a pile of books as Valerian finally spotted Arcturus. "Dad!" he cried, dropping his spade and clambering from the cove. Juliana turned at the sound of her son's shout and smiled as she saw Arcturus. Valerian charged over the grass toward him, and Arcturus realized he was more terrified of this moment than he had been when the Goliath had had him dead to rights on Unura Sigma. Valerian launched himself like a missile, and Arcturus caught him in his arms as the boy wrapped himself around his neck, laughing like a lunatic. Arcturus was surprised at how light he was. The boy weighed next to nothing.
"Dad, you're here! I wanted to talk to you last night, but Grandfather said I was too tired. But I wasn't, I really wasn't, I promise!"
Arcturus didn't know what to say. He'd never had any problems speaking to Dorothy when she was younger, but she was his little sister, and he had known her and loved her since her birth. Valerian was 7 years old, and this was their first meeting. What do you say to your son when he's 7 years old and you've never met him?
"That's quite all right, Valerian," said Arcturus eventually. "I think your grandfather was right. Anyway, I think I was too tired as well."
Arcturus put Valerian down and was summarily led by the hand toward the excavated cove where the boy had been working.
"I want to show you my dig," said Valerian. "Do you want to see it? I'm looking for aliens."
"At the bottom of the garden?"
"Well, not aliens exactly, but fossils of them. You know what fossils are?"
"I do indeed," said Arcturus. "I do some digging myself, you know."
"I know, my mum told me," said Valerian. "She said you're the best miner in the galaxy."
"Did she now?" said Arcturus as they passed Juliana.
"Yeah, she said you were a big soldier, and then you became a prospector, and that you're gonna be rich, and that you're the best miner ever, and—"
"Valerian," interrupted Juliana, "slow down. Show your father what you've found so far."
"Sure, yeah,"
said Valerian, dropping to his knees beside the tray of his finds. Arcturus knelt on the grass beside the tray as Juliana brushed a strand of honey-blonde hair from her face. Beneath the sunlight, Arcturus noticed how pale her skin was, pallid and without the light golden sheen of Valerian's. She caught his glance and turned away as though embarrassed.
"I think I'll leave you two boys alone for a while," said Juliana, pushing herself to her feet and ruffling Valerian's hair. "Will you be all right?"
"Yeah,"
said Valerian, without looking up from his finds. Arcturus nodded to Juliana and saw the desperate hope in her eyes.
"We'll be fine," he said. "I'm sure we can stay out of trouble for a little while, can't we, Valerian?"
"You bet,"
agreed the boy. Juliana made her way back toward the house, and Arcturus watched her go. Now that he was over the initial shock of discovering that he had a son, he was reminded of his former desire for Juliana. Aelin Pastor's daughter had always carried herself with an elan that was wholly natural and effortless. But as Arcturus watched, he saw that elegance had all but vanished. No, not vanished, but changed. Had motherhood changed her, or was he simply seeing her through different lenses that time and distance had crafted without his noticing? More the latter, he suspected, for, by any objective reasoning, Juliana was still beautiful. In some ways, more so. Last night he had wondered if they might yet be a family. But if he was honest, the burning desire he had once had for her was now cold and dead. The tactless light of day cast its unflattering illumination over the idea, and Arcturus knew that any such notion was wishful thinking at best, dangerous delusion at worst. Arcturus desired an heir, that was certainly true, but a family life? He turned back to Valerian as the boy said something. Sorry?
I think this is alien,
said Valerian, holding up a piece of shell that even Arcturus could see was a cracked shard from the shell of one of the domesticated Eumogen insect creatures. Yes, I think it is. Probably a giant winged monster from another galaxy.
You really think so?
Oh, undoubtedly, said Arcturus, lifting a piece of fossilized bark. And this looks like it's a scale from some kind of alien lizard, don't you think? Valerian nodded sagely.
Yeah, that's what I thought. A big man-eating lizard that could swallow a whole squad of soldiers in a single bite. Did you see anything like that when you were a soldier?
Arcturus shook his head. No, I didn't, but I'm quite glad about that. I don't think I'd have wanted to be swallowed whole.
Well, no, I suppose not, said Valerian. That would be stupid.
Arcturus took a closer look at his son as the boy rummaged through his finds and held each one up for his inspection. Though he bore the genetic hallmarks of a Manxk, Valerian did not have the physicality of Arcturus or Angus. The lad was thin, much thinner than even Dorothy had been at his age, and his arms were skinny and without definition. By Valerian's age, Arcturus was a fine athlete, and had become proficient with the dueling sword. Not that in this modern age of gauze rifles and missiles Arcturus had much use for an archaic weapon like a sword, but the harsh lessons had taught him balance, honed his muscles, and provided him with a proper appreciation for the martial arts. Given Juliana's disposition, it was unlikely she had encouraged such pursuits, and the sheen of sweat on Valerian's brow was testament to his lack of stamina. "Are these your books?" asked Arcturus, as Valerian finished showing him the junk he'd pulled from the riverbank.
"Yeah, they were Mom's, but she gave them to me to keep."
"May I?" asked Arcturus, reaching for the books.
"Sure!"
Arcturus lifted the top volume, a thin picture book on archaeology, complete with diagrams of animal skeletons and geological strata. He remembered reading this book as a child, and seemed to remember giving it to Dorothy. As he examined the next book, Valerian said,
"That's my favorite. Mom gave it to me for my last birthday."
The book was leather-bound, its cover edged with gold thread, and its title printed in elaborate cursive script. "Poems of the Twilight Stars," read Arcturus, opening the book and turning its pages. The interior was filled with color plates depicting fantastical beasts and verses of escapist nonsense that talked of ancient beings that walked between the stars in ages past. He read one of the poems, a ridiculously trite piece composed of numerous rhyming couplets that used childishly overblown similes. A quick flick through the book revealed that every single poem was similarly hokey and worthy of nothing but utter contempt. This was what Valerian was reading. A quick examination of the spines of the other books revealed one to be a guide to understanding your inner soul, while the other was a history book of Umoja. At least that was something worth reading. "This is yours?" asked Arcturus, holding up the book of poems.
"Yeah, I've read them all, but that one's my favorite. Mum reads it to me before I go to sleep at night."
"And this is the sort of thing you like? No military books or adventure stories?"
"I'm not allowed books like that. Mum says that the galaxy's a horrible enough place as it is,"
said Valerian.
"She says I don't need to read that kind of thing. She says it'll just upset me."
"Does she now?"
"Yeah, she likes that one, too."
"But you're a young boy. You should be reading action and adventure stories. Space battles and heroes. My father gave me Logan Mitchell, Frontier Marshal, when I was about your age. It's a classic. Have you read it?"
Valerian shook his head.
"No. What's it about?"
"It's about a man called Logan Mitchell who keeps law and order on one of the fringe worlds. Lots of guns, lots of girls, and plenty of shootouts with corrupt officials. Logan's a hard-talking, hard-fighting man who always gets the bad guy. Pretty simple stuff, really, but it's good fun and full of blood and guts."
"Why would I want to read about blood and guts and shootouts? That sounds horrible."
"I thought most boys liked reading things like that."
"Well, I don't," said Valerian. "I don't like guns."
"Have you ever fired one?"
"No."
"Would you like to?"
Arcturus saw the gleam in the boy's eyes and smiled. Like most people who professed to dislike guns, Arcturus figured Valerian had never actually fired one, and had probably not even ever held a firearm. There was something about firing a weapon that appealed to the primal urge in everyone, male or female, and even avowed pacifists couldn't deny the thrill of unloading a powerful weapon, even if only into a paper target.
"Come on, then," said Arcturus. "I have a gauze rifle and a slug thrower on the Kitty J. It's time you learned something about being a man."
Valerian lay back on his bed, struggling to hold back tears of frustration and disappointment as he rubbed analgesic ointment into his shoulder, where the butt of his dad's gauze rifle had bruised him black and blue. If Valerian hadn't already hated guns, he would have learned to despise them thoroughly during the time his father had spent with him. The last 7 days had to rank as the greatest and worst week of Valerian's life. The greatest because his dad was here, and he was just as he had pictured him, tall, strong, and handsome. Everything his dad said sounded clever and important, even if a lot of it was beyond Valerian's understanding. The worst, because nothing Valerian did seemed good enough for him. Valerian had greeted every day as a chance to win his dad's approval, and every day he hoped he was going to grow up just like him. He found himself trying to adopt his dad's mannerisms, his walk, his posture, and even his speech. It was just a pity that his father paid little or no attention to Valerian's many acts of devotion, seeming only to notice the things he couldn't do. The lessons with the gauze rifle and slug thrower had been a disaster, the savage recoil of the rifle knocking Valerian onto his back, and the bucking pistol spraining his wrist. The guns were loud, and even when he managed to hold them straight, he couldn't hit any of the targets his dad set up at the edge of the river. Every failure seemed to irritate his dad, but no matter how he concentrated, squinting down the barrel and pressing his tongue against his upper lip, he could not get the hang or love of firing a weapon. Not only that, but his favorite books had been consigned to the trash and replaced with freshly uploaded digitomes of economics, history, technology, and politics, things he wasn't interested in, and which didn't have any aliens in them. They were confusing, and used big words he didn't understand. None of them had any stories in them, apart from the history ones. But even they were really boring and didn't have any pictures of the bits that sounded like they might have been exciting. The one thing Valerian did enjoy was the sparring with wooden swords, which he and his dad engaged in on the lawn before the house. The weight of the sword was unfamiliar, but his dexterous hands could move it quickly and nimbly around his body. Though he was bruised and sore at the end of each of these sessions, his dad would look at him without the more usual expression of disappointment and nod. "You're fast," said his dad, taking his arm and squeezing it hard. "But you lack power. You need to build up your strength and stamina if you're going to be a swordsman."
"But why do I need to be a swordsman?" Valerian had protested. "Surely no one fights with swords anymore now that we have guns."
"And if you find yourself without a gun or you run out of ammunition, what will you do then? Anyway, learning how to use a sword isn't just about fighting with one. It also teaches you balance, speed, coordination, discipline, all things you sadly lack, I'm afraid."
That had stung, for it was harsh and unnecessary. His grandpa had argued with his dad after Valerian told him what had been said. Valerian had heard them shouting at each other from behind the closed door of his bedroom. Grandpa had left the house yesterday, and though Valerian didn't know what was going on, he had seen that his grandpa looked really worried. His mom told him that the ruling council of Umoja had been called to an emergency sitting, whatever that was, and that something very important was going on. She didn't say what that might be, but Valerian could read his mum's moods as easily as if she had spelled them out, and he could tell she was worried. As well as what was worrying her about Grandpa, he knew she wasn't too pleased with his dad, either. But she had kept her opinions to herself as far as Valerian knew. At least, he hadn't seen them argue. With Aelin Pasteur gone from the house, Arcturus helped himself to another measure of the man's brandy and sank into one of the leather seats before the fireplace. He sipped his drink, its taste pleasant enough, and remembered his first sip of brandy, the night the Confederate assassins had come to kill them at the summer villa. Thinking back to that night, Arcturus remembered sitting in the dining room and talking to his father and felt a sudden and wholly unexpected pang of nostalgia for those long-ago days. Back then, everything was simpler, he mused, then realized this kind of thinking was just the rosy mist of memory softening problems that, at the time, had been huge and calamitous. Time, he knew, had a way of distorting the truth of experience, embellishing past pleasures, and diminishing hardships. Though he was still a young man, Arcturus felt old now. Part of that was no doubt the fact that he had a son, a factor surely designed to make any man feel as though he had advanced in age, if not maturity, by an order of magnitude. Arcturus wondered if his own father had felt like this when presented with his newborn son. He didn't think so, since Angus would have had 9 months and more to get used to the idea. Fatherhood had been sprung on Arcturus like a bolt of lightning from an open sky. The idea had taken root, though, and instead of railing against the idea of a son, Arcturus had begun to feel that perhaps it was for the best he now had an heir, and had skipped the messy years of nappy changing and midnight feeds. He had sent a message to Korhal, tagged specifically for his mother and Dorothy, telling his parents of this latest development, though it had taken him several days to work out exactly how to tell them of Valerian's existence without casting himself in an unfavorable light. That hadn't been easy. Arcturus had fought Kelmorian pirates, been shot at by angry miners, and faced furious superior officers, but composing himself to record a message to send home and inform his family he was now a father, had been the most nerve-wracking experience of his life. Arcturus remembered when he'd been about 8 or 9 and had broken one of his mother's ornamental dancers with a poorly thrown padball. He'd sweated for days to pluck up the courage to tell her he'd broken it. The sensation engulfing him as his finger hovered over the record icon on the vidsys was uncontrollably familiar to the cold dread he'd felt as he stood before his mother's drawing room bathed in a guilty sweat. He smiled, realizing it didn't matter how old you were, your parents would always be figures of authority. And it never got any easier telling them something difficult. Just as you would always be their child, no matter that you grew up, fought battles, made a life for yourself, and perhaps even started a family of your own. The evolutionary dynamic between parents and their children was inescapable. In any case, he'd sent word of Valerian to Korhal, and 3 days had passed without a response, which surprised him. He had expected his mother to respond more or less instantly to the news that she was a grandmother. And Dorothy? She was now an auntie. If anyone should have reacted with glee, he would have expected it to be her. Arcturus knew Dorothy would love Valerian, but what kind of relationship could he expect to have with the boy? Would they bond, or would they remain distant, as Arcturus and his own father had? The last week had given him an inkling as to how their relationship would go, and it was not a pleasant realization to discover. It would likely be one of disappointment. The boy was weak and displayed no aptitude for the skills and enthusiasms a man needed to prosper. Arcturus would journey to Korhal soon to formally present Valerian to his family, and the boy would need toughening up if he was to become a worthy successor. In the meantime, he'd received word from Diamond DeSanto regarding the claim, and the news was all good. The initial core samples brought up by the rigs was about as pure as it ever got, and the yield from the rocks was like nothing any of the workers had ever seen. Arcturus smiled as he recalled the excitement in DeSanto's voice as she spoke of the value of the claim. She'd also mentioned a rumor going around the interguild networks that the guild wars were in fact over, that the Kelmorians had lost. Arcturus hadn't heard anything of that news, since Aelin Pastor had no scene viewers in his home, claiming they showed nothing but Confederate propaganda and mindless, brain-rotting melodramas anyway. Arcturus could sympathize with that view, so he'd connected remotely to a UNN satellite feed via the Kitty J's console, and, sure enough, the channel carried the triumphant news of the defeat of the Kelmorians. Images of marching marines and hundreds of gleaming siege tanks rolled across the screen, and the gushing announcer spoke of the craven capitulation of all enemy forces, as though the Confederate military machine had just defeated the most bloody regime imaginable instead of a loose alliance of pirates and miners. Was this why Aelin Pastor had been called away? Bored and slightly disgusted by the relish the UNN was taking in its paymaster's victory, Arcturus had disconnected with the feed and returned to Pasteur's home to pour himself the brandy that warmed him as surely as the crackling fire in the hearth. Arcturus was enjoying this rare moment of solitude when he heard Juliana enter the room behind him. He recognized the hesitancy of her step and knew it signaled another argument about the boy. "What is it, Juliana?" he said without turning.
"Your son is in tears again," she said.
"Why doesn't that surprise me?"
"Why are you being like this?" said Juliana, coming around the chair to stand before him.
"Like what?"
"Why are you being so hard on Valerian?" she asked, ignoring his question. Her face was hard and pinched with anger. "Can't you see he adores you? Even though you belittle him every time you see him. He He's just met his dad, and all you can do is tell him how bad he is at everything.
Arcturus put down his brandy, angry with her now.
That is because he is bad at everything. He can't even hold a gun, let alone fire one. The books you've been foisting on him are turning him into a flower-wearing believer in universal harmony, and he's as skinny as a rake. There's no meat on his bones, and he gets tired after even light calisthenics. If I'm hard on him, it's because I'm trying to undo the damage your mollycoddling has done.
We love him here, Arcturus, said Juliana. We don't force him to do what we think he should do. I thought you of all people would respect that. Our son is free to choose what he wants to learn and what he wants to be passionate about.
Arcturus shook his head.
That's just the kind of woolly-headed nonsense that'll leave him unprepared for life beyond this cozy little bubble you've built around him. You're raising a bookish, effeminate weakling, Juliana. The galaxy is a hard, ugly place, and if you carry on raising him like this, he'll not survive when he has to face it alone. Do you understand me?
I understand, all right, snapped Juliana. You want to make a carbon copy of yourself.
And would that be so bad?
Retorted Arcturus, surging to his feet.
At least I've made something of myself. I've gone out into the galaxy, gained real experience, and forged my destiny with my own two hands. What's the boy ever going to manage on his own? He's a Minsk, and he's made for great things, but he'll never amount to anything like this.
Whatever he wants to do with his life is up to him, said Juliana. We can't choose the path of his life for him.
Utter rubbish, said Arcturus. Children need discipline, and you have conspicuously failed to give him that. He's too young to know the right path when he sees it, so it behooves us to make sure we put him on it.
Juliana balled her fists, and Arcturus saw the strength he thought she'd lost resurface in her.
I wish you could hear yourself, Arcturus. I really wish your younger self could hear what you're saying now.
What are you talking about?
Everything you rebelled against when you were younger, that's what you become. You become your father.
Don't be foolish, Juliana. I am nothing like my father.
She laughed bitterly.
For someone so clever, Arcturus, you can be so blind. I listened to all the things you tell me over the years, the grand plans for the future, and your ambitions for greatness, and I believe them. I think on some level I still believe you will do great things. But you won't be doing it alone anymore. You have a son, and he needs his father.
And I'm doing what a father needs to, Juliana. I'm giving him the benefit of my experience to turn him into a man.
He's only 7. Let him be a child, pleaded Juliana. Does he need to grow up just yet?
Arcturus was about to deliver a withering reply when the door opened, and one of Aelin Pastor's servants entered. Immediately Arcturus could sense the man's urgency.
"What is it?"
asked Juliana, turning and snapping at the man.
"A communication for Mr. Manx," said the servant.
"A message?" said Arcturus. "And you had to interrupt us for that? I'll open it later."
"No, sir," said the man. "It's not a message. It's a real-time communication from Korhal."
Arcturus frowned. To communicate in real time between worlds was incredibly expensive, and could only be done by those with access to the most powerful and advanced equipment.
"From Korhal. Is it my mother?" he asked.
"No, sir, it's a Mr. Feld," said the man, "and I'm afraid he says he has some bad news."
Arcturus cradled the brandy bottle in his lap, knowing that draining the last of its contents was the wrong thing to do, but not caring for right and wrong any more. His tears had long since dried, but the grief still tore his heart with cold steel claws. The words Feld had spoken echoed within his skull. "They're dead. All of them." They were etched into his memory with a permanency that could never be erased. It was impossible, surely. No one could have penetrated the security around them. No one could have defeated the manifold security systems that protected them from harm. It was impossible.
They killed them. Oh, God, Arcturus. I'm so sorry.
He'd known something was wrong the minute he'd seen Actonfeld's face. His image on the vidsys had been grainy and static-washed. The signal degraded after so immense a distance piggybacking along myriad relays, boosters, and carrier waves. A communication like this was the equivalent of your phone ringing in the middle of the night and jerking you from sleep with a deep, gnawing fear in your belly. No one phoned with good news in the dark. No one went to the expense and trouble of a real-time communication with good news.
"What is it, Field?"
Arcturus had said, sitting in front of the vidsys unit he'd used to send the news of Valerian's birth to Korhal.
Sorry, Arcturus. I'm so sorry, said Feld, tears running down his cheeks. Sorry? For what?
Listen, Feld, spit it out. What's wrong?
Said Arcturus, a lead weight of cold fear settling in his stomach.
They're dead. All of them,
wept Actonfeld.
Who?
Said Arcturus when Feld didn't continue.
All of them,
sobbed Feld, struggling to form the words.
Angus, your mother, even Dorothy.
Arcturus felt as though a great black void had opened up inside him. His hands began to shake and he felt cold. His mouth was dry and his mind stopped functioning, unable to process the reality of what Feld had just said.
No,
he said at last.
No, you're wrong. This can't be right. You've made a mistake. You must have made a mistake, Feld. They can't be dead. No, I won't allow it. I'm so sorry, Arcturus. I don't know how it happened. Everything was normal. All the security systems were functional. They're still functional. I just don't know.
Arcturus felt his limbs go numb, as though they were no longer his to control. A rushing sound, like the sea crashing against the cliffs below the summer villa, roared in his head. Feld's mouth moved on the screen, but Arcturus no longer heard the words. His hands pressed against his temples, and tears of grief, anger, and sucking, awesome loss flowed with them, as if he'd taken an emotional emetic. His humanity flowed from him in his tears, and every petty feeling he'd ever harbored toward his family, every feeling of compassion, and every shred of restraint was washed away in a tide of hot tears. The sheer, unimaginable scale of what had happened settled upon him. It was too much. No one could suffer such a crippling loss and remain whole. The power of his grief tore through him like a hurricane, breaking chains of restraint, honor, and mercy, scouring away all thoughts except one shining beacon that offered a ray of hope, a slender branch of survival to which he could cling.
Revenge.
The people that had caused him this hurt were going to die. All of them. Arcturus knew that killings like this could only be the work of the Confederacy. Only they had agents with the skill and gall to perpetrate something so heinous. Only they had the temerity to think they could get away with it. Well, Arcturus Gmengsk was going to disabuse the Confederacy of that notion. What was it his father had said? When all you have is a hammer, everything starts to look like a nail. The diamond clarity of the thought swept away the drag of his grief, and he took a great draught of air, feeling himself fill with righteous purpose as he did so. His tears ceased, and his back straightened. "Tell me what happened," said Arcturus, his voice icy and controlled.
"The dead, isn't that enough?" said Feld. "You need to come back to Core Hall."
"Oh, I'll be coming back soon enough," promised Arcturus. "But tell me what happened." Feld saw the urgent need in his eyes and nodded, wiping a hand across his face. Arcturus was impressed. Say what you like about Acton Feld. He was a professional.
"I came up in the morning with the daily security brief, just like I always do," said Feld, shoring up his own walls against the grief with commendable discipline. "I passed through the biometric identifiers, swiped my card, and went through into the penthouse. Angus is usually waiting for me, but he wasn't there this morning, which immediately made me suspicious. Catherine, I mean your mother, normally has a pot of Java on, but I didn't smell it. That's normally the first thing I notice, you know, the smell of fresh Java, but not this morning. I knew something was wrong. So I made a sweep of the apartment."
"What did you find?"
Feld took a deep breath. "I couldn't see anyone. There was no sign of forced entry. I mean, nothing. But the door to the balcony was open."
"And?" said Arcturus when Feld didn't go on. He could see it was taking all of Feld's self-control to keep speaking, and Arcturus prepared himself for the worst. His jaw tightened. He'd already had the worst. What else could there be?
Feld nodded. "I went out on the balcony, and that's where I found them. The damn force field had shorted out, and they were just lying there like they were asleep. Your mother, Dorothy, and your father. Dead.
How did they die?"
"Does it matter?" snapped Feld. "Why the hell do you need to know something like that?"
"I need to know," said Arcturus. "I don't know why, I just do."
"They were shot," said Feld. "Catherine and Dorothy were shot, one in the heart and one in the head."
"And my father? Was he shot too?"
Again Feld paused, his face averted as though unwilling to meet Arcturus's gaze.
"No. He wasn't shot. He was decapitated."
"What?" cried Arcturus. "Decapitated? What are you talking about?"
"You heard me," shouted Feld.
"They cut his damn head off, Arcturus, and we can't find it. The sick bastards took it with them."
He'd terminated the communication soon after, telling Feld to wait to hear from him, that he'd be in touch to sort out what their next move would be. He'd marched from the room and returned to the drawing room, where he'd lately been arguing with Juliana, and swept up the bottle of brandy. An hour passed, maybe more, but Arcturus didn't feel the passage of time, his brain whirling in a million different directions as he tried to process the gaping emptiness in his soul. He took mouthfuls of the brandy, the liquor as potent as ever, but seeming to leave him unaffected. His entire body was numb to its powers, and he drained half the bottle before hurling it into the fire with a splintering crash of glass.
"Waste of good brandy,"
he hissed as the alcohol burned off in bright flames. He heard the door open behind him.
"Arcturus," said a man's voice. "I'm so sorry. I came as soon as I heard."
He turned to see Aelin Pasteur and Juliana standing at the entrance to the room, as though afraid to intrude on his grief, but happy to watch from the sidelines. His heart twisted with contempt.
Juliana's face was streaked with tears, and she held Valerian close to her. The boy's eyes were wide and fearful, not quite comprehending what was going on. Valerian untangled himself from his mother and came over to stand next to Arcturus.
"Is your mom and dad dead?"
he asked. Arcturus nodded.
"Yes, Valerian, they are. And my sister, too."
"How did they die?"
asked Valerian.
"Hush, Valerian," said Juliana. "Don't ask such things."
"The Confederacy killed them," said Arcturus, his voice low and threatening. "They killed them because my dad spoke out against them. They killed them because they are animals."
Valerian reached out and hesitantly put his hand on Arcturus's shoulder.
"I'm sorry there, Dad,"
whispered Valerian. Arcturus looked into his son's eyes and saw the honest sincerity of a child, his expression uncluttered by adult notions of propriety or reserve.
"Thank you, Valerian," he said.
Aelin Pastor approached and guided Valerian back to his mother. He took the seat opposite Arcturus and said,
"Whatever you plan to do next, I can promise you that you'll have the support of Umoja." "Like my father did," said Arcturus bitterly.
"More than that," said Pastor. "Arcturus, I've just come from an emergency sitting of the ruling council, and in the wake of the Kalmorians' defeat, Counselor Jorgensen has announced the formation of the Umojan Protectorate. It will be an organization to keep our colony free from Confederate tyranny, to resist their expansionist policies, and offer a safe haven to those who stand for freedom."
"Very noble of you," said Arcturus, "if a little belated."
"You might be right," admitted Pastor, "but it's a start."
"A start," said Arcturus, staring into the crackling fire. "Yes, a start."
A sudden, terrible thought lanced into Arcturus's brain with the force of an impaler spike, and he looked over at Valerian and Juliana. Fear clenched in his guts and took the breath from him.
"What is it?"
said Pastor, seeing the urgency in his eyes.
"Juliana, you and Valerian have to leave," said Arcturus, rising to his feet. "Right now!"
"What? I don't understand. What are you talking about?"
"They know,"
said Arcturus, pacing the room, his thoughts crashing together like a convoy of ground cars rear-ending one another.
"Oh, if they don't yet, they will soon."
"Slow down, Arcturus," said Pastor. "Who knows what?"
"The Confederacy," snapped Arcturus. "The message I sent to my family about Valerian, if they're good enough to defeat Feld's security systems without breaking a sweat, then it's a mathematical certainty they know where I am and that I have a son. We're loose ends, and the Confederacy doesn't like loose ends when it comes to murder."
"You think they'd come here? To Umoja?"
said Juliana, holding Valerian even tighter. Arcturus laughed, the sound hollow and coming from the bleakest, emptiest part of his soul.
"Don't think for a moment they won't. They will do whatever it takes to destroy their enemies. You have to get out of here and stay on the move, or they'll find you. And that can't be allowed to happen."
"Don't be ridiculous," said Pastor. "We are well protected here."
"Ridiculous," said Arcturus. "If my family's killers can penetrate the Sky Spire's security, they will simply walk in here and kill you all in a heartbeat. No, the only way to evade people like that is to not be here when they come for you."
"He's right, Daddy. We need to go,"
said Juliana, her voice brittle with fear, though Arcturus knew that fear was for Valerian and not herself.
"I won't let anything happen to Val."
Pastor hesitated, and then nodded reluctantly.
"I'll have a ship here within the hour."
"Stay on the move," warned Arcturus. "Don't stay in any one place too long."
"You're not coming with us?" said Juliana.
"No," said Arcturus. "They don't know it yet, but the Confederacy has just created the greatest enemy they will ever know."
"What are you going to do?" asked Pastor.
I'm going to burn the Confederacy to the ground, hissed Arcturus.
Chapter 15. The sword came at him in an arcing line of silver, and Valerian twisted his wrists to bring his own weapon up to block. The blades connected with a shriek of steel, and he spun from the reverse stroke as Master Miyamoto's sword darted forward. Valerian's sword came down, deflecting the stroke as he backed away from the relentless attack. Sweat ran down his face in runnels, and his breathing came in short, sharp gasps. In contrast, Master Miyamoto looked as serene and unflappable as he always did, no matter whether he was pouring tea or executing flawless sword movements. Dressed in a simple, cream-colored keikogi and hakama, Master Miyamoto was as unreadable as ever, no trace of expression betraying his intended movements in this dangerous ballet called a sword bout. Valerian wore identical training clothes, though tailored for his smaller, 9-year-old frame, which had finally begun to fill out as he grew older and took more exercise. He was still slender and ascetic-looking, but the last 2 years had seen his shoulders and arms begin to strengthen and offer promising hints of the man he might become. They were alone in the garden. Master Miyamoto allowed no one to observe their training, not even Valerian's mother. Roughly built walls of high stone enclosed the garden, a rectangular courtyard of gently swaying plants, freshly tended herb patches, and a slate-paved sparring area next to the eastern wall. A fountain gurgled peacefully in the center of the garden, and the cold air was thin, scented with the earthly smell of ripe crops. This region of Icarus IV always smelled, due to the loamy richness of the soil that made it such a fertile world for agriculture, and the faint yet unmistakable hint of chemical fertilizer. Birds perched on the high walls, the only spectators able to observe Valerian's grueling training rituals, and their twittering conversations were like a chorus of amused theater-goers enjoying a boy's humiliation at the hands of a fencing master.
"What is the meaning of victory?"
said Miyamoto, slowly lifting his sword up and back.
"To defeat your enemy," said Valerian, circling as Master Miyamoto slid sideways.
"No,"
said Miyamoto, launching a lightning-fast thrust toward Valerian.
"That is not enough."
Valerian averted the attack, his speed impressive, and slashed his sword at his trainer's side. His blade struck empty air, and he realized he'd been lured into the attack as the flat of Master Miyamoto's blade struck him painfully on the bicep.
"Then what is it?"
he yelped. Every time he failed to answer a question correctly, Valerian received a stinging rebuke from Master Miyamoto's weapon.
"It is to destroy him," said Master Miyamoto, "to eradicate him from living memory. You must leave no remnant of his endeavors. Utterly crush his every achievement, and remove from all record his every trace of existence. From such defeat, no enemy can ever recover."
Master Miyamoto's sword looped around his body in a series of perfectly executed maneuvers that, had Valerian attempted them, would have seen him limbless, earless, and dead.
"That," said Master Miyamoto, "is the meaning of victory. You would know this if you had paid attention to the books on your father's reading list, or the one I gave you."
"I read that one,"
said Valerian, returning to the guard position and bowing to Master Miyamoto.
"Not closely enough. Again."
Valerian nodded and once more dropped into the en garde position, his long blade extended before him. After 3 hours of training with Master Miyamoto, Valerian's arms burned with fatigue, and his chest felt as though a fire had been set in his lungs. Master Miyamoto returned Valerian's bow, and the two of them circled one another, their swords shining in the afternoon sun.
"The enemy comes at you in a great horde," said Master Miyamoto. "How do you fight?"
Valerian cast his mind back to the text his tutor was referencing. It was a treatise recovered from the data vaults of the Reagan, the supercarrier that had brought the colonists to Umoja. Supposedly written by an ancient warrior king of Earth, its words were instructions in the arts of war, diplomacy, and personal discipline. The book had no official title, but Master Miyamoto called it the Book of Virtues, and seemed to know its text verbatim. Valerian had read the book, as it was high on the list of approved texts his father had set him, but he found it difficult to recall its teachings, while trying to avoid a stinging slap from the flat of Master Miyamoto's blade.
"Quickly," said Master Miyamoto, his sword raised to strike. "Do not think. No!"
Valerian lifted his blade, letting his mind float back over the many evenings he'd sat at his desk with the pages swimming before his tired, gritty eyes. He had read the book a dozen times or more, and as he let his thoughts concentrate on the tip of his tutor's sword, the words came to him without conscious thought.
"It's best to try and direct them into a narrow defile or enclosed space," Valerian said.
"Why?"
A slash to the body.
"So that their numbers work against them."
A rolling block.
"How will they do that?"
A thrust to the chest.
"Crowded together, those at the front will impede those behind."
A parry and riposte. Valerian shifted left and launched his own attack.
"The push from the rear will prevent those at the front from retreating or finding a better path."
"Very good," said Master Miyamoto, easily deflecting Valerian's attacks. "And what of balance?"
"It is the key to success,"
said Valerian, smiling as yet again the words came easily to him.
"Why?"
repeated Master Miyamoto, parrying a clumsy attack and rolling his blade around Valerian's sword.
"A leader who puts his faith in his guns will be outmaneuvered,"
said Valerian, deflecting the blow and circling around to his right.
"Then he must train all his warriors in close quarters combat," offered Miyamoto.
"No, for then he will lose his force to enemy fire,"
countered Valerian.
"Very good. So what does it mean to have balance?"
"It means that every element of an army must work in harmony, so that its effectiveness is greater than the sum of its parts."
Master Miyamoto nodded and lowered his blade. He spun the weapon quickly and sheathed it in the scabbard at his belt.
"We are done for the day," he said.
Valerian was relieved, for his body was aching. But he was also disappointed, for he had finally begun to appreciate the lessons of the Book of Virtues and how to access them while he trained. It was just a beginning, but it was an important beginning, he felt. He returned Master Miyamoto's bow and sheathed his sword, running his hands through his blonde hair. He wore it long, pulled tightly into a ponytail during sword practice, and its golden hue was no less bright than it had been when he was a youngster. Master Miyamoto turned on his heel and made his way along a stone-flagged path toward the fountain at the garden center. He took a seat on the ledge around the fountain and dipped his hand into the cold water. Valerian followed the swordmaster and sat next to him, taking a handful of water and splashing his face.
"You are improving," said Master Miyamoto. "It is good to see."
"Thank you," said Valerian. "It's hard work, but I think I'm beginning to get it."
"It will take time,"
agreed Miyamoto.
"Nothing good ever comes without effort. I remember telling your father the same thing."
Valerian's interest was suddenly piqued, for Master Miyamoto had never spoken of his dad before now, save when he had first arrived. Miyamoto had arrived a few weeks after Valerian and his mother had fled Umoja, informing Juliana that Arcturus Mengsk had retained him to become the boy's tutor in all matters martial and academic. His mother had been furious at his dad's presumption, but the matter was not up for discussion. Master Miyamoto had only been persuaded to leave his position at Sterling Academy to teach the boy for an exorbitant fee, and only Valerian's desire to win his father's approval had persuaded Juliana to let Miyamoto stay.
"You taught my dad to use a sword?"
asked Valerian.
"I did,"
Miyamoto nodded.
"It casts a long shadow, Valerian, but it is my hope that you will be able to escape it and fulfill your potential.
I bet he was good with a sword, said Valerian. He looks like he could fight.
He was a fair swordsman, conceded Miyamoto. He was strong and won most of his bouts, before even a single blow was struck.
How?
There is more to fighting than simply wielding a sword, said Miyamoto. More often than not, a man is defeated by his own doubts.
I don't understand.
In any contest of arms, where life and death rest on the outcome, most men's fear will see their opponent as stronger, faster, and more capable, explained Miyamoto. Such doubts only serve to make it so. To win, you must have utter belief in your abilities. No doubt must enter your mind.
Is that what my dad did?
Miyamoto stood, as though deciding that he had said too much.
Yes, your father had complete faith in his abilities, but victory is not the only measure of a man.
It isn't?
No, there is honor. A man may lose everything he has, yet still retain his honor. Nothing is more important. Always remember that, Valerian. No matter what anyone else tries to teach you, even your father.
Honor is more important than dying?
Absolutely, said Miyamoto. Some things are worth dying for.
Like what?
Defending noble ideals, or fighting for the oppressed. The honorable man must always stand firm before tyrants who would dominate the weak. The abuse of power must always be fought, and men of honor do not stand idly by while such evils are allowed to exist.
Just like my dad, said Valerian proudly.
Master Miyamoto bowed to him.
No, he said sadly. Not like your father.
Valerian stripped off his training garments and dumped them on the floor of his bedroom. He grabbed a towel and made his way into the bathroom, turning on the tap and stepping back from the tub as chilly water gurgled and spurted from the showerhead. Eventually the water warmed and Valerian stepped under the hot spray. Over the last year he and his mother had spent on Icarus IV, Valerian had gotten used to a liquid shower as opposed to the sonic ones he'd grown up with on Umoja. The hot water soothed his muscles and refreshed him in a way the vibrational removal of dirt molecules and dead skin from his body just couldn't. Even though it was wasteful to use water this frivolously, Valerian decided it was entirely worth it. He stepped from the shower and began toweling himself dry, stopping for a moment to look at himself in the full-length mirror on the back of the door. Though he was young, his body was developing quickly, and his upper body strength was growing every day. Accompanied by a squad of soldiers, he ran every other morning, jogging around the patrolled perimeter of the Umojan Agrarian Complex, a distance of some 6 kilometers, and was pleased with his increased endurance. He flexed and posed in the mirror, enjoying the fantasy that he was some dashing interplanetary hero, like his dad. Despite Master Miyamoto's words, Valerian was proud of what his dad was doing. Valerian returned to his bedroom, a cluttered space filled with books, digitomes, an unmade bed, and silver-skinned trunks full of clothes. His collections of fossils, rocks, and alien artifacts were proudly on show in a number of display cabinets, and a number of antique weapons were hung on the wall. They had belonged to the previous owner of the mansion in which they now dwelled, surely the most salubrious accommodation they'd stayed in since leaving Umoja. And Valerian had liked them so much, he had left them there. He'd asked Master Miyamoto if he could train with some of the more exotic-looking weapons, a falchion, a glaive, or a falx, but his tutor had forbidden him to touch any more weapons until he was competent with a sword, at least. Still, it did no harm to have them around, as many were plainly hundreds of years old and gave him a connection to times long gone. In a small way, they made it easier to hold on to the concept of alien civilizations existing in forgotten ages of the past. The concept of millions of years ago was almost impossible to grasp. But a few hundred years was easy, and by such small steps, he could imagine larger spans of time. Valerian cleared a space on his bed and dressed himself in loose-fitting trousers and a blue shirt of expensive silk. He settled back on the bed and lifted the copy of The Book of Virtues Master Miyamoto had given him and began to read. Unlike the majority of Valerian's other books, this was an old-fashioned one of paper pages bound together within a leather cover, which bore an inscription on the inside in letters he couldn't read. Master Miyamoto had said his own father had written the words on the morning of his death. Only after much cajoling had Master Miyamoto told Valerian what the words meant. Valerian's tutor had lifted the book, and though he clearly knew the inscription by heart, his eyes